Maury Sendak began writing stories when he was 9 years old. During high school, he worked for All American Comics, taking Mutt and Jeff newspaper strips and adapting them to comic books. Later on, his willingness to write about painful issues like separation and divorce made him an unusual children's author and a controversial one as well. In addition, several of Sendak's books were banned when they were first published because they included his anatomically correct drawings of naked children. Sendak has won numerous awards for his work, including the Caldecott Medal for Where the Wild Things Are. His other books include Higgledy Piggledy Pop, In the Night Kitchen, and Outside Over There. In the 1980s, Sendak turned his attention to opera. He adapted Where the Wild Things Are into an opera, and he's designed the sets and costumes for such classic operas as Mozart's The Magic Flute. Sendak's latest children's book, Dear Millie, is a recently discovered Grimm's fairy tale for which he did the illustrations. It's the story of a little girl whose mother sends her to the woods to save her from an approaching war. I asked Maury Sendak how Dear Millie was first discovered.
The way it came about in the world was so fascinating. As a letter sold in Germany by Wilhelm Grimm, his letters are hard to come by, as are his brother's Jakob's. And then to discover that it was more than a letter. It was a letter which had embedded in it an unrecorded fairy tale, a variant. There are many stories about St. Joseph, but this was a variant on that story, I think especially tailored to the needs of whoever Millie was.
How did you imagine Millie? Because in illustrating the story, you had to imagine who she was.
Yeah. Well, we had to make her up. There was no way, unfortunately, of ever finding out who Millie was. She obviously was a real girl back in 1806 that Wilhelm wrote to. He did write to a number of children. But she obviously meant something special to him. And one can only presume certain things. One can only presume tragedy had struck in some way. One can only presume it may have been a parent. Maybe it was both parents. We don't know. But he's consoling her. And in the opening part of the letter, it's so kind of sweet and clumsy, the way adults are when they're trying to explain something difficult to a child. And then he quits and says, listen, I'll tell you a story instead, as though the story as metaphor will be clearer to her, which of course it is. And it's such a compelling story because he's telling her such a hard fact of life. And, of course, in romantic style, in early 19th century style, in language we wouldn't use now, but nevertheless as vigorous and perhaps even more honest than language we would use now, he's telling her that there is such a thing as death.
And that's something I think that parents have a very difficult time talking to children about.
Yes, they do, but children do not have a difficult time hearing about it. I mean, kids are interested in that the way they're interested in the food that goes in their bodies, in the sexuality of their lives, in what happens to grandpa and grandma. I mean, they're interested. They don't have the same sentiment or anxiety about these subjects that we have as adults. Of course they don't, because they don't quite see it in terms of their own lives. However, this story represented such a clear and honest approach to the subject that I fell in love with it. Also, the ramifications of the story, that this was yet another war where a mother is gratuitously separated from her child, which is the history of the human race, alas. And one could then graft onto that more contemporary wars, if you will, which I did. I grafted on the Second World War. I grafted on the Holocaust.
Well, there are images of children, and they remind me of the faces of children that you would see in concentration camps.
Or, they are.
Or even grown-ups that you might see, but have that very...
that haggard, worn look, wiped-out look. Millie is granted a vision in the early part of the book when she's in the woods, and she's granted a vision of the future, and she sees that she is in a long line of abandoned children, that this is a historical fact. That's what was so touching about the book, that not only was it a beautiful tale written at the beginning of the 19th century by a favorite writer of mine, but also it had such contemporary power.
I think I read somewhere that hearing the Klaus Barbie trials, that played into your drawing of the story and kind of worked upon you in, I suppose, the idea of children being the victims of such horribleness.
Yeah. Well, it was during maybe two summers ago that the Barbie trial was on in Paris, and I was working on the book, and of course, like so many people, I was listening. Very disappointed that he didn't get on trial, that he was protected. And then being maddened by what they did get him on, which was the murder of some 40 innocent children who had safely hidden in a house in a little village in Isieux in France. And just before the war ended, he got them and killed them. And I was so moved by that, and I'm illustrating a book about a little girl who loses her life for no reason, that I incorporated those lost children of Isieux into Paradise, where Millie is, to commemorate them and do them homage.
And Mozart is with them.
Yeah, Mozart is with them because he's my hero.
Yeah.
And he's employed. He's written a little chorale for them. In my own head, I know the music. They're singing. One of my favorite things that Mozart ever wrote is a tiny piece called the Ave Verum Corpus. It's one of the very last things he wrote. It's about all of 2 minutes. And it's the most exquisite religious hymn. And that's what I hear them singing. And it's as though he's written it for the children of Isieux.
Do you have particular fears of abandonment? I mean, I think all children fear losing their parents. But I think some children fear it more than others.
Well, yes. As you say, it's a natural component of growing up that you're going to worry. You're going to hear of somebody else who lost mommy or daddy. Then doesn't that make you vulnerable? Will you lose mommy? Or if grandma dies, does that mean you die? Of course, it comes on very early. I think it was particularly so in my growing up because I grew up during the Second World War and being Jewish and having parents who just got out of Europe and living through the knowledge of all of my relatives dying. I should say all of my father's relatives dying. It was a constant. And in my house, there was constant mourning all during the 40s. Plus the photographs of children who were my father's nephews and nieces, who were all my age, my brother's age, and my sister's age. And while we lived in America and were safe, they died. And I think that was traumatic. It was meaningless and wild and terribly upsetting. And my memory of those years, unfortunately, are just very long, grief-stricken years with parents who never recovered, never, ever came out of that shock.
Did they talk about their grief? I mean, or was it something that was just, you could feel in the household?
No, as is typical of these people, they did not discuss it with their children, probably for the same bad reason that they would be sparing us. Mm. I say bad reason because they weren't. Their grief frightened us. Could they have talked about it? It might have made more sense to us. We knew what it was. We knew people were dying because they were Jews, but we didn't know what that had to do with us. Because we felt like Americans. I suppose just as the German Jews felt like Germans. But it wasn't discussed. It was impossible. My parents were typical parents. They did not discuss things with children.
And with your sisters, did you almost mourn together with them? Or was it a kind of private mourning?
Well, growing up in the war, the Second World War, was a unique experience for our generation. My brother was in the army. He was in the Philippines. We didn't hear from him for months. We were terrified he was dead. My sister had married just before the war began, a wonderful, wonderful man who was killed almost instantly in the invasion of Anzio. So, yes, the war made a huge dent in our lives and compounded the relationship between my brother and my sister and myself. Happily, he came home safe. But yes, it still is in our lives. It's very definitely in our lives. It comes up frequently, and when I did Millie, it sprang to life as though it had never lain down. So it'll always be there until I die.
And for you, are books like Dear Millie, and I know there's some other ones for you, kind of working out some of these childhood fears. I mean, are these books a kind of exorcism for you of the fears?
Not consciously. I don't do a book to work out childhood fears. That's a therapeutic business, which you should do in your analyst office, which I did in my analyst office for many years. But no, they are creative impulses. They take on dramatic impact and excitement, and you want to express them on paper. You don't think of them as, exorcising. Mm-hmm. They do, in fact, but that isn't your primary purpose. That's along the way. That's the good you get out of it. It's the byproduct. But then again, that's true of all works of art and of any artist that ever lived, that where else does it come from but from their innermost souls, if you wish, and in expressing it. And if you're real and if you're getting the real stuff out, well, then you're going to deal with yourself in some very primary process way, and you're going to get something. It may not make you happy, but you're going to find something out.
My guest is writer and illustrator Maurice Sendak. You were a frail child, I mean, a sickly child,
yeah.
as I understand.
Yeah.
Did you think that made you particularly vulnerable then to, I suppose, events going on in the world where if you don't feel strong, maybe you feel like you can't quite cope with what might happen?
Well, I knew that I was vulnerable to death. I knew that. And I was not, you know, it was not uncommon in those days. We're talking about the 30s when there weren't sulfa drugs or penicillin, and childhood ailments were lethal. And you could die from pneumonia and whooping cough and scarlet fever. Occasionally children still do, unfortunately. So that I was probably one of many children who was afflicted with a series of these devastating illnesses, which probably led me to have a weak heart, which brought on a coronary in my late 30s. So that you had a strong sense of impermanence from early. You couldn't have translated that into death. That would have been meaningless. But you were in a state of alarm, and you knew your parents were in a state of alarm, and you knew that somehow you were more vulnerable to something, and that you were especially taken care of. I was lucky because I had two older siblings, my brother being 5 years older, my sister 9, like a double set of parents. And they surrounded me, you know, and my brother became my very best friend. And I have happy memories of illness with him sitting, drawing pictures and cutting them out and amusing me. I don't have unhappy memories of being sick, oddly enough.
But you spent time in bed. I mean,
yeah,
in those days, children were sick in bed.
Oh, yeah, you were isolated from the family, and the only bit of life you had was looking out the window. It's by no accident that my first book was called Kenny's Window. I wrote in 57 or something. That was my life, observing other children from the window. I remember I've been quoted saying this, but it was so significant and funny when I was looking at kids with sleds out in the street, and I said to my father, can I someday go out and have a sled? And he said, it would be nice if we could, but being you, you'd probably catch pneumonia. Mm. So there was this rather untactful reminder always of my frailty, you know.
Did you also hear these children? Because as you described that, I could hear them playing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of my favorite occupations was when my grandmother came to stay with us, and she would hold me up on her lap at the window, and then she'd pull the blind down, the window shade down, and we'd make believe that it was sort of like a movie, because everything would change.
Against it.
And I remember a very particular moment when my sister and brother were in the backyard and they were building a snowman. I could almost see them. And they waved from downstairs and she suddenly pulled the blind down. And then, boom, she pulled it up again and my sister and brother were not there. And it was like a tableau vivant. It was like a movie. They were there, they were not there. And so there were games played at the window that were memorable.
When did you start to draw?
About then. I mean, I copied my brother primarily. Being the second son, you were constantly battling to be as good as the first son. And he was smart, and he did well in school, and he drew. And of course, I loved him, and I passionately hated him all at the same time. And I wanted to do what he did. I copied his drawings, and he wrote stories, which I would illustrate, bizarre stories, which you couldn't publish now. They were so bizarre. But the business of illustrating began very early in the sick bed with storytelling and writing and drawing pictures. And that's how it all started.
And can you see, when you look at your work now, a kind of early beginning of the kind of style that you use? I mean,
no, look at Dear Millie, see nothing. I mean, my early style was lugubrious and terrible. I'm not being modest, it was. I had no training whatsoever. I didn't want to be trained. I did very badly in school. I was one of those kids who doesn't do well in a competitive situation like a classroom. So I refused to learn, even when it was something I liked, like drawing. I had to do it by myself, which I'm not describing as a virtue, it just was the way. And when I first went out looking for work, and my first drawings were incredibly bad, mostly my model was Disney. Those are the things that I saw, Disney cartoons. Everybody had huge yellow shoes, if not black ears. Dear Millie is a long ways from where I was, because it was a long apprenticeship, really learning by sheer dint how to draw.
Maurice Sendak is my guest. I know that the Lindbergh kidnapping was something that was very frightening for you, and I imagine for all children growing up in that time, which I suppose had a kind of innocence, a kind of carefree feel to it, to think that a child was not safe in their own bed and that somehow a stranger could come and whisk you off. And your book Outside Over There is really a reworking of some of those early feelings.
Well, go back to what we were talking about, of being vulnerable and ill when you're a child and uncertain of your existence, and then the most famous child in the world is taken away. Healthy, beautiful, blue-eyed, blonde-haired baby boy who is the apple of everybody's eye, who is our version of Prince Charles, as close as we ever got. It's hard to resurrect that time and what it meant. It was the Depression. It was beginning rumbles of the war. And the horror of that experience, the terror of that experience, that almost every child would have felt, I particularly so, because it's almost as though I depended on his coming back alive for my own survival. It was a strange feeling, and I remember it. I remember the headlines. I remember the radio accounts. I remember Mrs. Lindbergh's tearful voice on the radio. And I remember us all holding our breath, convinced that, of course, he would be well and sound, because nothing could happen to such a child, and, of course, he was found dead. It was a terrible experience.
You've said one of the curses of my profession is I remember everything. Do you?
That's true. Yeah, I do. I do remember everything.
And I guess...
Except important things, like where is my wallet, where is my keychain, and what am I supposed to do today? But on the personal level, I do. I mean, memories flood me, and they don't get soft with time. They just remain vivid. It's tiring. It's very tiring.
Do you remember things like gestures and those small moments that seem to be filled with feeling and with importance?
Not all, but probably like you and most human beings, you remember an odd assortment, sometimes very insignificant memories. It's very strange, the ones that are chosen to be recollected. They aren't the big moments. They're often the very small moments. But yes, when I remember them, I can see my father moving, or I can see my brother gesturing, or I can see my mother leaning over a table. And I can recreate it. I do.
Do you feel you write for children? I mean, you write with children in mind, or are you really writing for yourself? Because I don't think you're not the way a sort of typical children's author.
I'm not writing at all with children in mind. But I am writing apparently for children, although that isn't what my intention was. It's a good intention. They're the best audience in the world. But if I am writing for children, it's sheer accident. I don't know how come. It's apparently the only way I can write. My gift is very tailored in a very specific shape. I can't write a Norman Mailer or a Saul Bellow type book. You know.
Have you tried?
And no, I haven't tried, because I have a very, I think, pretty shrewd sense of my limitations and what I can and cannot do. I don't try. I have no ambitions to write a grown-up book, so to speak. I think I say in my books grown-up things, but I say them in a way that is significantly different from other middle-aged writers. But I don't know why. I can't explain that. I've often finally decided it was in the wiring when you're being shaped as a fetus that it occurs there, that you come out. It's something I've long thought about, and it's something I've never understood.
Do you like to be around children? I mean, do you like the kind of hubbub when children are around?
No, not particularly. And I'm as fussy with the kinds of children I'm around as I am with the adults, because I'm afraid childhood is not an umbrella that makes all of them wonderful. There are as many tedious children as there are tedious adults. And so finding the lovely, wonderful, you'll find more children. Yes, there are more children that are less tedious than there are adults. But the ones that are wonderful are supremely wonderful and very touching. And I've had children in my life and in my family, and I don't have children of my own.
Did you ever want children?
Yes, I did. We all do when we're young. But I'm very grateful now at 60 that I didn't do it. I steal everybody else's children. All my friends who have had their children and completely messed up their lives, I now become the good uncle. So I have a bunch of nice kids who come to me.
So you give them back.
I have usurped children. Occasionally I give them back.
And do children try to find you out? I mean, do you get letters from children? Do they try to contact you?
I get letters from children. They don't try and find... Children have a whole different set of values. They are not impressed by stars at all. They don't want to meet you. Only their parents think they want to meet you. I have suffered. My ego has suffered terribly from those autographing sessions where little kids are pushed forward after waiting on a line for an hour when they desperately have to go to the bathroom to meet a short, bearded man. They don't know who the hell he is or could care less. And the mother is saying, "Honey, this is the man who wrote your favorite book." And you see the expression on their face saying, "What does that mean? What does he have to do with my favorite book?" They don't make these connections, which their parents think they do. And then the book is shoved at me, and I'm told to write his name or her name and my name, and they've been brought up to never scribble in the book. And here a perfect stranger is writing in their book. And so they're offended, they're tired, they're miserable.
They have to go to the bathroom.
And they have to go to the bathroom, they take it out on you, and they start screaming and crying, and you get a reaction like a little girl once looked at me and screamed, "He's too short." You know, took a lot of willpower not to straighten her out. I don't hang out with kids. I don't. That isn't my business. When I lecture, I much prefer going to colleges and universities and talking to young artists, writers, theatrical people who are getting into the business, where I can be of use to them as a guy who's been in the war and tell them what it's like. Children, the books, that's what I do for them. And I think that is the best I can do for them. And I think my physical presence is a confusion, offers them up no pleasure whatsoever. And they tend to really want to be entertained, and that's not what I do.
Well, my favorite book, not just of what you've written, but I think almost all-time favorite book is Where the Wild Things Are. And I, even just almost the placement of the words and how you move through the pages has this terrific kind of rhythm. And I must say, when I get to the last line, which is, "And it was still hot," talking about the cereal, I am moved to tears. And there's something about that last line that... Well, I guess that's where the love is, in the sense that he was a bad boy, and he went on this fantasy.
And he was loved anyway.
And he was loved anyway.
Yeah.
And it's a very reassuring last line.
I think so. The book is was 25 years old last year.
Yeah.
It's wonderful to have lived to see its 25th anniversary and to have enjoyed it. It started out as a notorious book, which was... hugely condemned when it was published, and I've lived to see it become a, quote, classic. That's fun. Max and his cuckoo friends are establishment figures at this point, and that's nice, but it was hard-earned. It was very hard-earned.
Are you surprised that your books started out being controversial, and In the Night Kitchen is another one? You see the little boy's penis.
Yes, oh well, yes, that was the first live penis, so to speak, in Kitty Bookland.
Yeah.
I didn't know that when I did it. I assumed everybody knew about such things. But no, I didn't set out to be notorious, nor did my editor, Ursula Nordstrom, at Harper's. We set out to do books that I wanted to do, and she, as editor, was there to help me do them. We never thought of them as breakthrough books or scandalous books. That was never our intention. It was always to our chagrin and grief that when they were published, they came out to such disorderly noise. It was nonsense. It was just ridiculous that In the Night Kitchen was kept out of any number of libraries in America because of his nakedness, and they had to paint a diaper on him in order for, I mean, that was much kinkier than merely his sex organ. Strange.
I know that you work in opera and you have a variety of interests, including set design. What kinds of things are you working on now?
I'm working on a bunch of things right now. I'm working on two screenplays. I wrote a screenplay based on a very early book of mine called Very Far Away, which I wrote after Kenny's Window, which I've always been very fond of. And I've amplified it and thickened it out to a movie, a live-action movie, which a number of people are interested in, and I'm hoping will get published. It's the same theme. It's my one Johnny One-No theme, children caught up in adversity for a moment and how they deal with it. That's the theme of all my books. But this is sort of a comedy too. And now I'm also working on a screenplay based on Dear Millie, another live action movie, which to reassure anybody listening that I'm not stretching a 10-minute fairy tale into an hour and a half musical. The fairy tale will take about 10 minutes of the film. The rest of the movie is about an incident in Wilhelm's life, which is based on fact, but which is purely invented, and how it leads, this moment in his life leads him to enact this fairy tale later in the film. I'm working on three operas, Idomeneo by Mozart, La Clemenza di Tito by Mozart, which will be arranged, hopefully will be produced in his anniversary year, 1991, anniversary of his death, and Hansel and Gretel by Humperdinck. So there's a lot on the drawing table right now.
Well, it's been a real pleasure to have you here, and I thank you very much for talking to us.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.